giving a little background on it. But then very quickly we'll be concentrated on the sort of simplest case from a field theoretic point of view, which is a free scalar field in a Gaussian state. In other words, its wave function is described by a Gaussian. But we'll do it by starting with a set of coupled harmonic oscillators, of which the field theory is kind of the limit, continuum limit, and derive some general formulas for the entanglement entropy for a subset of a set of coupled harmonic oscillators when the whole assembly is in its ground state. So that's kind of the perspective. In the end, you'll see, although a lot of this, most of this is very old work, there's some open questions which I've listed as research problems in the end, which I'll mention when we get to them. And okay, so let me start talking a little bit about the background of entanglement entropy. So of course, I haven't actually referred to it yet, but the possibly most interesting aspect of entanglement entropy is the fact that it obeys what's called an area law, that the entropy between two regions, if you focus your attention on one region and ignore what's in the other region, you have an effective mixed state, and the entropy associated with that, assuming that the global state is pure, is often just something proportional to the size of the boundary of the region, which is an area in 3+1 dimensions. And so more generally, it's called an area law. But the idea of black hole entropy had its origins. The idea of entanglement entropy had its origins in the study of black holes. As you probably are familiar with, a large number of different lines of evidence now lead to the conclusion that associated with a black hole of area A, there's a entropy called the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which is in proportional to the area in units in which you take 8 pi g of the rationalized gravitational constant to be 1. So you often see this as a over 4 g. And the question is, what could give rise to such a strange dependence a priori? Because normally we're used to, in an extended system, that the entropy is proportional to the volume of the system, right? In most condensed matter systems, most other systems, you would expect that. And you sometimes do get that, like if you have a thermal state. But in the vacuum state or in some sufficiently low-lying state, the evidence is that there's this kind of area law. And in fact, it seems to be something associated with the horizon itself. This area is, of course, the radius of the surface area of the horizon of the black hole. And the question is, why would you get an area law? So if you think about it a little bit, you can see that there's going to be many contributions, potential contributions to the entropy. And one of them is this entanglement entropy. It's the fact that, I mean, the thing that makes the black hole is that in, at least if you limit yourself to the classical case for precision, then no information whatsoever can get out from the inside to the outside. So if we're outside and interested in describing the physics of what's going outside, we really don't have to know much, or in principle, anything about the inside. So the physics for us will be described by some sort of effective state, assuming quantum mechanics continues to work sufficiently well in quantum gravity, some effective state which, as I think is very familiar to everyone now, will be a mixed state, even if there's some sort of quantum fields which are in a pure state overall. So then the question is, so that's one natural source of entropy for a black hole. And the question is part of all, is all or part, I'm not going to address this but anymore other than just raise it now, but is all or part of the black hole entropy, entanglement entropy? That is entropy due to this fact that the exterior region is in an effective mixed state. If there are quantum fields around, it's in an effective mixed state of those quantum fields, which could include, of course, gravitons. Now, there's a whole host of questions related to this, which I'm also not going to discuss, but it's worth being aware of them. One of them is what's called, I'll just say them in words, one of them is what's called the species problem, which is if you believe that the entropy is partly or even wholly due to this entanglement, you might worry that the value of the entropy would depend on how many scalars, how many different quantum fields there are. If they were free fields, just say asymptotically free or whatever, in some approximation, you would think that each new field would add its own contribution to the entropy. So why would the answer not involve some complicated function depending on the number of fields? And why should it be such a simple geometrical expression like this? One suggestion that's been put forward to explain this is that, well, it's not just the area, it's the area in it's the area in units of the Planck length. And this being, I haven't put the h bar in here, I've set h bar to 1 in this formula. But the Planck length is some sort of macroscopic gravitational coupling constant. It will be subject to renormalization. It could be that the effects of the different fields, if you add a field to the theory, then you'll change also the effective gravitational coupling constant because it will be renormalized by the presence of this other field. And it could be that compensates exactly. And then people are working on that. The picture is not entirely clear yet. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that one of the early people to actually work on that question was Rob Myers several years ago. In fact, most of the stuff I'll be talking about now, a lot of it has some connection to people in this building, people associated with perimeter. Another closely related question to this issue of the geometrical nature of the entropy is wrinkles, what I'll call wrinkles. There is some evidence that if you take the back reaction into effect of these scalar field fluctuations, it'll cause, of course, small fluctuations in the shape of the horizon. There's some evidence that those are much larger than Planckian, which you might naively expect, and that they could be viewed in a kind of dual picture or a kind of, let's say, effective large-scale picture as the source of the entropy. Okay, so that's the origin of black hole entropy. But then after some lapse of time, it seems to, the topic seems to have exploded, and it's showing up all over in physics now, the idea of entanglement entropy. So in the case of condensed matter, I suppose the most we should hear, see if Giffre will agree with this, but in condensed matter, I suppose the most prominent application is what's called topological order, to diagnose what's topological order. In particular, you get a degeneracy of the number of ground states of such a substance. And the entanglement entropy, in a way that I won't go into, can be used to as a meter to read out the degree of degeneracy, the number of ground states. And that's, and the area law comes in there. And then beyond the, there's a correction to the area law, which gives you information on the number of ground states. Then that's led to its own developments in which the area law, which is a law for the entropy, is gone. That's a entropy of some effective, maybe I should write it down, some effective or reduced, as it's sometimes called, density matrix associated with the external region of the black hole here, or now just of some region in a sample of this kind of condensed matter, that the area law applies to the entropy of this effective density matrix. But there's something that's called entanglement Hamiltonian, which comes from looking at more details of the spectrum of this operator rho hat. The entropy is a particular invariant made from the spectrum, which is the sum of lambda, or let's call them Pn log Pn inverse. Okay, so this should be a familiar formula to everyone. But if you, these Pn are the eigenvalues of that density matrix, and then by looking in detail at the eigenvalues, you get, you can take the log and you call that the entanglement Hamiltonian. But anyway, by looking at the details of the eigenvalues, you can get even more information. So that's a whole development. Another is in quantum field theory. I'm just now reviewing the different places in which entanglement entropy has proven important in physics recently. So in quantum field theory, I suppose, well, the most interesting applications have to do with what's called the C theorem, or things, generalizations of the C theorem. So C theorem and friends. I won't go into this, but it has to do with how, it has to do with the renormalization group flow of quantum field theories. In other words, how the theory, the effective theory, changes under coarse graining from one scale to another. And the C theorem is a very general theorem that tells you, in, that deals with flows from one conformal field theory to another. Maybe, I don't know if Jaume is going to cover it, but a very nice thing is that there's a proof of the C theorem. It was originally proved by some methods that had nothing to do with entropy, or certainly entanglement entropy, but a very recently beautiful proof by Huerta and Cassini has managed to relate it to the properties of entanglement entropy, some properties of entropy called strong subadditivity. Very nice. At least that's a 1+1 dimensional proof. Well, then there are analogs in higher dimensions. But it's I think, one of the most interesting, unexpected at least to me, is that there would be such an intimate connection between this very general quantum field theoretic relationships and the idea of entropy. So another place in which, another place in which entanglement entropy has shown up is quantum information theory. Which is, you could think of as kind of the theoretical wing of quantum computing, I suppose. And here you just, here it's just, well, in quantum computing, it's generally believed, or the most people share the point of view, that the essential, one of the essential resources for doing quantum computing is entanglement between the different qubits or the different elements of the computer. So you'd like to have a measure of how much entanglement do you have. And entanglement entropy provides a measure, so it's being used as a quantitative measure of the degree of entanglement. This is at least works in the case where you have two subsystems of a globally pure state. If you divide the system into two subsystems and you deal with a globally pure state, in that case, this entanglement entropy produces a very useful, a very appropriate measure for the degree of entanglement. I think as soon as you go to more subsystems, like tripartite, as people call them, it's less obvious what's the right measure. But this is the starting point for measures of entanglement in quantum information. So another thing that I want to just refer to, which is also follow on from this work that I will be talking about, is the space-time formula, which gives you a notion of entanglement entropy from, see, all of these, although I didn't stress the fact, all of these other cases, you're dealing with a moment of time, you're dealing with a state at a moment of time, and you're basically just dividing space. But ultimately, entropy should be some, well, at least in my view, entropy should be something of a space-time nature, because everything in physics is something of a space-time nature. And it'd be interesting whether you can make a formula for the entanglement entropy, which, so this is the entanglement, which is related, which does not require you to choose a hypersurface. And that's something that some of us have been working out, specifically Yasaman and some other people who aren't here. So there is such a formula, and its derivation is closely connected to what I will be deriving. I haven't included a reference to it because it's not directly a reference for what we're doing, but if you're interested, there are some recent papers on the web, on the archive, and actually on my own website that describe this relationship. And this, the motivation for a lot of this, and here the space-time case, or the quantum field case, departs from condensed matter. The motivation for this is the need for a Lorentz invariant cutoff. As we'll see, or as I'll refer to several times, and as we'll see in more detail in a couple of lectures, the entanglement entropy, although it all sounds very nice, in the case of a field theory, it's infinite without a cutoff. And so it's not, well, it has no meaning at all. In the condensed matter case, you have, of course, a natural cutoff because there are not, a quantum field is only an effective description of the system, and on small scales you have atoms or spins or whatever. But in the case of quantum field theory, as it stands, there's no physical cutoff, and furthermore, there's no distinguished rest frame. So in quantum field theory, I mean, in the condensed matter case, there's not only a cutoff, but there's a distinguished rest frame, and you implement the cutoff in that frame. In the case of space-time, that doesn't really make sense. It's not, in some sense, consistent physically to do that. So you need something like a Lorentz invariant cutoff. That's another whole issue. One of the things we're working on now is for the causal set to provide a Lorentz invariant cutoff and see how that affects the resulting formula. So I'm just referring to that. And then the final thing that I just want to refer to give some background to the whole subject is, so I mean, if you look at this list, you see that it covers a huge range of different physical parts of physics, right? Black holes has to do with quantum gravity, condensed matter, a large range of applications, quantum field theory, that's the standard model, quantum information, you know, quantum computing. And then the last thing that that I want to raise here is quantum foundations, which is also a field that's pursued in Perimeter. And how does that get in? Well, we can ask a question. I just try and indicate the meaning of this question without being able to describe it fully. But when we talk about this entropy, we could ask this entanglement entropy, or is the kind of entropy in general that comes, that's defined like this, sometimes it's called the von Neumann entropy. It's essentially the Boltzmann entropy, the quantum generalization of the entropy that goes into the Boltzmann's H theorem. The question is this entropy, so which can be written like this. Here I wrote it out in terms of the eigenvalues, but the sort of the way of writing it directly in operator language is the trace of rho times log rho inverse, probably familiar to most of you also. So the question is it a Gibbs or a Boltzmann entropy? I suspect that doesn't maybe mean, does that question mean something to anyone here? Because let me just indicate what it, so the very important distinction in the history of thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, which is how to think of entropy. Even now we don't, in relation to the second law, for example, the law of entropy increase, even now it's a controversial thing and a thing that people, philosophers of science are constantly debating about. Is entropy a sub, another way of saying it, is it something to do with us, or is it something to do with the real world? So if you say it's something to do with the real world, it's the Boltzmann entropy, and if you say it's something to do with our ignorance or our more subjective nature, that's the Gibbsian way. What it means in a technical sense is that, do you think of, let's go back to classical statistical mechanics where the distinction is clear. If we think of the microscopic state of the system, does it have an entropy? The Boltzmann idea was, yes, it does, because the entropy just corresponds to the number of microscopic states that belong to the macroscopic state to which the given microscopic state belongs, okay? So in other words, if you coarse grain the microscopic picture, then each macroscopic state, or you might call it mesoscopic state, corresponds to a large number of microscopic states. And the entropy is basically just the log of that number of microscopic states, sometimes called complexions. So as the system evolves along its world line, its trajectory and phase space, it's always in one of these cells, macroscopic cells, and so the log of the number of states in that cell represents the entropy. That was the Boltzmann idea, an idea behind Boltzmann's H theorem. But the Gibbs entropy is that you're dealing with some sort of probability distribution over the microscopic states, like in a canonical ensemble, and the entropy is a measure of the uncertainty, sort of information theoretic uncertainty, in that probability distribution. But quantum mechanics is, so the distinction is clear, and then you can argue about their relationships, but the distinction is clear classically. But quantum mechanically, of course, it's not, because we don't know what represents the true microscopic state. Is it the density matrix? Is it a pure state? Is it something else? These are all, you know, if you say it's one of these things, then you already have probability. And the meaning of the wave function seems to be probabilistic in the way that the meaning of a trajectory classically is not probabilistic. So the question becomes clouded, and the way to clear away the cloud would only way to clear away the cloud would be to answer what is actually the microscopic reality to which the quantum state refers. That's of course the province of quantum foundations. That's what people are aiming to answer who work on that. So let me make one last remark just to strengthen. I mean, I think this, just looking at this set of applications already makes a strong case that entanglement entropy must be an interesting topic. But there's one extra reason, which is just in this final remark. So this entanglement entropy is something that's special to quantum mechanics. It just doesn't, there's no analog of it. There's of course an analog of entropy in classical physics. I was just referring to it. But there's no analog of entanglement entropy. It's not possible in classical physics, given say a bipartite system, that is given a system which consists of two subsystems, which you can mentally at least or physically divide into two subsystems. If you know everything there is to know about the state of the total system, then you know everything there is to know about the states of the subsystems. So in some sense, you know, it's not holistic. The whole is not greater than the sum of the parts in that sense. So if the when you know everything that there is to know, then as you if you completely specify in every detail the state, then the entropy is zero, or at least it's zero unless you bring in some sort of coarse graining like you do in defining the Boltzmann entropy. But in the fundamental way, the entropy, if we take, say, the Gibbs point of view and we compute the entropy from that point of view, we'll get zero. And so if we get zero for the combined system, we'll also get zero for the subsystems, right? Is that clear to everyone? Because if I tell you all the low, if say it's two sets of molecules or two sets of atoms, and if I tell you where every atom is in this, let's say it's a box of gas, and I just divide it conceptually in two, this is a bunch of atoms, this is a bunch of atoms, they all have some velocity. The state of the whole system is given by telling for how many atoms there are, where they're located, and with what velocity they're moving. This is at one fixed moment of time, right? If I give you all that information, then, of course, you also know for the right half where every atom is, and you also know for the left half where every atom is and how it's moving, and vice versa. So giving full information for the full system, a complete description of the physical state of the full system, is equivalent to a complete description of the physical state for this half and the physical state for this half. But for quantum mechanics, it's not true. The most complete description that we know of, anyway, now, for the combined system is just some wave function for the whole system. We'll come to this in a second. So this, the Hilbert space for this is a tensor product of an Hilbert space for each of the two subsystems. And so we have a vector, Hilbert space vector in that tensor product. But that complete description, as I think is familiar to everyone, but we'll review it now, in case it's not, just for the sake of completeness, I'm going to review it, is that even if you have the complete information for the full system, if you limit yourself to observables for the subsystem, you no longer have as complete information as is conceivable. That is, it's the effective state is described by a density matrix or a mixed state, and that has entropy. So you have, and that's entanglement entropy. So this is something that only happens in quantum mechanics. And so another motivation for understanding it is to just understand quantum mechanics itself. So is there sort of any questions, comments on this? Is just sort of an overview. No? Okay. Oh, there's one thing on the black hole that I didn't say. So let me go back and add one more remark on the black hole, which is going to be relevant when we come to talk about the area law, which is that, well, let me just write it here, that there's, as I did say, the entropy, entanglement entropy is infinite without a cutoff. What I didn't say is what you find for the black hole, that the entropy, so now if we put a cutoff, let me call the cutoff L. L, by L I mean a length, a physical length, a small length, below which we assume no degree, we ignore any degrees of freedom that might be present. If you don't put a cutoff, then you get S equals infinity. In other words, if S is zero. But if you do put a cutoff, this is nothing, this is for any surface in space-time. The thing that I had in mind was the black hole, but we can say the same for any quantum field theory, and in flat space even, is that we get something which in 3 plus 1 dimensions, situation is a little different. This means 4-dimensional Minkowski space. 3 plus 1, it's a little different in lower dimensions, but in 3 plus 1 dimensions, it's up to, I should put it like this, up to some numerical factor. It's the area in units of the cutoff. Therefore, if we go back to quantum gravity now, since we know the coefficient here, and we know the exact numerical relationship between area and entropy, at least to leading order in quantum gravity, this is somehow giving us information on the cutoff. Although we're not at the stage of having a complete quantum gravity theory, what it highlights is that it's actually important to get right the numerical relationship between the cutoff and the entanglement entropy, and in particular, the answer may depend and will in general depend on how the cutoff is implemented. So it's important to have a way of implementing the cutoff which is Lorentz invariant, and in which you can actually work out the numerical coefficient here, because ultimately it's giving you one of the most direct handles or sort of microscopes for looking into the deep structure of space-time. So that's one thing that I wanted to mention. But the most important thing is this kind of relationship between the cutoff and the area. And this is one thing that we'd like to understand. However, as I said, I mean, to do this right, you would need a Lorentz invariant cutoff, as I mentioned. But in the rest of the talk, I'm going to not do that because we don't understand fully how to do it yet. So I'm going to go back to the more prosaic point of view where we fix a frame and we look at the cutoff in that frame. Okay. When we get to the cutoff. Okay, so that's now all I wanted to say in a very general way. And now the next thing is to define entanglement entropy. Again, this will be for most of, or a large fraction of you, I think it'll be review, but just for the sake of completeness, let me go through that too. So again, I'll put in like a little apology, which is I would love to do this direct from the path integral. I don't know how to do it, at least in the general non-equilibrium case. It's also interesting, and I think it gives a deeper understanding. It allows you to answer certain questions you couldn't have answered from the from the way I'm going to do it, there's the algebraic standpoint. That is, when you think of a quantum system in terms of the algebra of operators and the state on that algebra. This may or may not mean anything too definite to you if you're not familiar to it, but there is this way of thinking about quantum systems. I think it gives a better understanding of entropy, and it was actually played an important role in this formula here, which I referred to, which you can look up in some of the recent papers. But again, although I would love to be able to do it from some over histories, and it, though I could do it in the algebraic way, it would just it would add a sort of formal complication to the discussion. So I'm going to do neither of those. I'm going to work with the absolute traditional or sort of textbook way of thinking about quantum systems in terms of a Hilbert space and a density matrix or density operator, if you like, in the Hilbert space, which has the property that, of course, that given any observable so-called operator, self-adjoint linear operator A in the Hilbert space, that its expectation value in the state rho is just trace of rho hat times A hat, right? So that, I assume everyone has seen at least two or three times in courses that they've taken on quantum mechanics. So that I will be assuming. Furthermore, we say that rho hat is pure, as it's called, if and only if it has the form like this for some state psi in the Hilbert space. Okay. Also, I think familiar. And that's also true if and only if, now I'll define the entanglement entropy. I mean, I'll define, sorry, the Boltzmann or von Neumann, whatever, entropy of the state rho hat, which I wrote somewhere up there. That's defined to be the trace of rho hat log rho hat inverse. You may sometimes see minus trace rho hat log rho hat. In other words, instead of putting the inverse there, put a minus sign in front, which you could also think of as, since if you look at this formula, the expectation value of any operator is just the trace of rho hat times this. You could also think of this as the expectation value of the log of rho of this log of rho hat inverse. Of course, it's a little funny. Mathematically this is true, but it may seem a little funny physically because this is not an observable in a normal sense. This is describing the state. But for purposes of doing computations, it's useful to be able to think of this. It's the expectation value of the log of rho hat inverse in the state that's given by rho hat. I don't need the hat there. This is the analog, as I said, of what Boltzmann, in the Boltzmann H theorem, called H, which I think is why sometimes in information theory entropy is called H. Just out of curiosity, how many have seen this Boltzmann H theorem? Have seen a proof of the Boltzmann? Three or four, something? Yeah, I recommend to look at it because you'll have a deeper feeling about the meaning of some of these ideas. It's always good if you find an idea confusing, and I don't know who doesn't find entropy confusing as an idea. If you find an idea confusing, it's always good at some point to go back and look at its origins, where people hadn't settled on everything and hadn't developed a whole formalism to go with it. Some of the ideas, basic ideas, and even controversies come out more clearly in such a situation. Okay, so this is the idea. This is just the idea of entropy. This is the definition of entropy that we'll be using. It's the analog of the Gibbs entropy, not the Boltzmann entropy. So classically, this rho would have been some probability distribution on phase space. So from a formal point of view, this looks like a Gibbs entropy. But now let's consider the case of a composite system. So I'll use this S, this German S, to represent a system. So suppose our system is a composite of two. Well, we know, again, people have worked out that in quantum mechanics, or quantum theories in general, what that means, although this is quite dodgy in quantum field theory, but let's pretend that it's not. So we can think that that's one reason you need that this algebraic approach helps sometimes. With each subsystem, we associate a Hilbert space, and the Hilbert space, a state space for the combined system, is of course just the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces for the subsystems, right? So if like you're doing a hydrogen atom, then this is the spin. One may be the spin of the electron, then maybe its position. So each one, spin in the space part of the wave function, you need the tensor product of those two. So in the simplest case, we'll take each of these to be a spin a half. I'll just do the simplest case now, and then at some point, I'll come back just for completeness and do the general proof. But it's anyway, I'm just proving something that's familiar to most people, which is that the effective density matrix for describing the subsystem is given by tracing out the degrees of freedom of the auxiliary system, or the neglected system, sometimes called ancilla. So we'll take the simplest case, which is a case of 2 by 2 Hilbert spaces, two-dimensional Hilbert spaces for each, so as it would be for a set of spin-a-half particles, or what people sometimes often like to call qubits in the quantum information context. And I'll assume that the overall state is still a pure state, so which we call psi, as usual. Therefore, since it's a pure state, well, I can write that here. Since it's a pure state, it's a vector. That just means it's just given by a single vector in the Hilbert space. So that, now let's suppose that that vector was equal to psi 1. No, let me write that over here. So if psi was equal to psi 1 tensor psi 2, then the effective state, as you can easily convince yourself, for the system 1 would be equal to psi 1, or if you express it as a density matrix, it's a pure density matrix, and so rho hat 1 would be equal to this psi one, right? In other words, the second one, just forget about it, just cross it off, and that gives you. However, when you have, that gives you the effective, I mean, now you're dealing with the first system. However, if you have the opposite extreme, which is the entangled case, as in an EPR state, then the total state is just, let's say we call the basis for the Hilbert space, let's say we call the two states U and D, you know, spin up and spin down for each system. Then a simple kind of entangled state would be U plus D, right? That's the EPR type state. Although people sometimes write a singlet putting UD plus DU, but now if that's the state, and we want to work out what is the effective density matrix for the first effects of description for the first subsystem. So let's consider an operator. Let's consider an operator A1 hat, which acts in the first Hilbert space. I identify Roman and whatever this is, Arabic numerals here. Then if we want to know, if we are interested in the expectation value of that in this global state, that means, of course, the operator, the global operator that corresponds to that question is A1 hat tensor, the identity operator, right? Further, so we, what we need to do is find the expectation, we're interested now in the expectation value of A hat. So we need to, which is just equal to psi A hat psi. So we need to compute A hat of psi, A hat acting on psi, which is just A1 hat tensor 1 acting on U tensor U plus D tensor D, which is just equal to, I mean, this is all very straightforward, but I'll try not to leave anything out. So it's just A1 U tensor U plus A1 D tensor D, right? And so now we have to put, where was it? This was psi, there's a square root. I think I've got a square root of 2 off. So actually psi, I'll correct it in the next line. That'll be 1 half times, now we need to say U tensor U plus D tensor D. We have to contract that with A1 acting on this, which was A1 U tensor U plus A1 D tensor D, right? Now if you look at this, so now when, you know, the general rule is sort of A tensor B dotted into C tensor D, when they're just product states like that, of course that's equal to AC times BD. So if we apply that in this particular case, we get four terms, but only terms, you see on the right-hand side, if we take, say, this term and this term, the D will hit the U, but they're orthogonal to each other. So we won't get anything, so we'll only get a contribution from this term and from this term, and they'll be 1. The second factors will be 1, and so we'll just get 1 half of U, A1 U, plus, from the second term, we'll get D A1 D times 1, So what does this mean? Well, remember, so we want to write this as trace of rho 1 hat, some effective density matrix, times A1 hat. Of course, it's not, I mean, unless you've, it's part of the general feature of quantum mechanics that it always can be written in this way. And if we want to do, how would we do that? What do we have to choose for rho 1 hat if we want this equation to be true? Many people probably know the answer already, if not most people. What we have to do is that rho 1 hat has to equal 1 half, we want to use in some sense the cyclicity of the trace, which is familiar. But just imagine taking this U hat and moving it over here. In other words, we want to use the fact that the trace, just a general thing here that I can write. We want to use the fact that A, some operator B, is also equal to the trace of O times B A, right? If you can think of it as a kind of aspect of the simplicity, of the cyclicity of the trace. You could put a trace here free because it's just a number, and then you could move the B. Anyway, this is true, right? This is easy. You can check, if you don't know it already, just check it in any basis, and you'll see that it's true. So what we have, given that, this is just, this tells us that we want row one to be this. But, right, that's the solution of this. But this is one, right? This is, because U and D are a basis, an orthonormal basis, this thing here is one. So it's just 1/2 times the operator one. Okay. So the effective density matrix, this is the famous fact, that when you deal with a totally entangled state of two spin 1/2 systems, the effective density matrix for either subsystem is the totally random one, even though you had, in terms of the original pure state, you had what's called complete information on the combined system. You have no information whatsoever on the individual subsystems. All the non-trivial physics is in the correlations between the two systems. Okay, so now what is the entropy? Maybe I should. Well, let's go back to our formula for the entropy, wherever it was. Here it is. What do I want to do? So what is the entropy now? The entropy of this effect of this row, why green? What happened? Yeah, the entropy of row 1/2 is just equal to the entropy of 1/2, the operator 1/2, times, if you like, times the identity operator, which was the expectation value of the log of rho hat inverse. So what it, rho hat inverse, of course, is 2. So that was rho hat inverse, obviously, is just 2 times the identity operator. So it's the log of 2. The log of this operator is just the log of 2 times the identity operator. So it's the expectation value of log of 2 times the identity operator. Log of 2, of course, comes just a number. And the expectation value of 1 is 1. So it's just log of 2. Okay. So in this simple case, it's a sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? This case that everyone talks about. I can't think of the nice word to say that. But this case, the most commonly talked about case, the entanglement entropy is just log 2. So it's like 1 bit of entanglement entropy in that case, which is the EPR state or the totally entangled state. So 1 bit of okay, so are there any questions? So this is the prototype of a calculation of entanglement entropy. Now a large part of our work from now on will be to generalize this to the case where you don't have just one, you don't have just two-dimensional systems, but you have n infinite-dimensional systems, each one corresponding to a harmonic oscillator. And we put, instead of choosing the state just by fiat to be this totally entangled state, we'll choose the state to be the ground state. So in fact, what we'll do is we'll now consider a system of oscillators that will have what you can think of just diagrammatically as divided into the oscillators which are sort of inside and outside some sort of boundary. I don't know how to draw a bunch of oscillators, but anyway, there's a bunch of oscillators here, and they're also coupled with each other. So that's the situation that we'll consider. We'll in fact derive a formula for a finite number of oscillators, so n oscillators. And then to get the field theory, we'll take the continuum limit, the limit of n going to infinity. Now that might be, well, the route I'm following is in some sense the most straightforward possible one. There's hardly any trickery along the way, although maybe at one or two points there's a little bit of cleverness, but otherwise it's just following your nose. It may not be the shortest route. If someone can come up with or knows of a shorter route, I would be very interested in that. But this is the sort of original one that I followed long ago, and this is the one that we'll be doing in the course. One other comment I wanted to make is that what you noticed here, because everything is defined so symmetrically, what if I had computed the entanglement entropy in the other, we talk about the entanglement entropy, but actually what I computed was the entropy of the effective density matrix, or the reduced density matrix of system one. What if I had computed the reduced density matrix of system two? What would I have got? The same thing. In this case, I certainly would have got the same thing because I set everything up symmetrically, so it's obvious that I would have got the same. But what if I had chosen a different state that wasn't so symmetric? It's not so obvious in that case, but it's true that you would always, as long as the total state is pure, you would always find that S of rho 1 is equal to S of rho 2. And that's a very important feature of entanglement entropy. Let me just say a little bit about why that's the case. And that's why we can talk about the entanglement entropy without specifying which system we have to refer to. So if you imagine a black hole in which we imagine ourselves outside and have no access to what's inside, which is the natural case, then we have some effective entropy for our reduced entropy, our reduced density matrix. But what about some person who happened to be inside and had no access to outside? That's not correct physically, because the person inside can actually receive information, of course, from outside. You can dive into the black hole. You can't come out. Nevertheless, you can ask the mathematical question. You can take a moment of time, that is, in this case, in space-time, that would be a Cauchy surface. You could take a Cauchy surface, divide the field into inside and outside, and ask what would be the effective density matrix for the inside observer, and what entropy would they get? And the answer would always be the same as the person outside would get, which raises the possibility of alternative ways of thinking about the question physically. But in any case, this is an important feature. So let me just say, I'm not going to prove it because we won't need it as such. It will follow, but let me just follow the state that this follows. What's called the Schmidt. Decomposition of What is it? Actually, I'm not sure. I think it's the Schmidt decomposition of, is that the right terminology? Anyway, it follows from the Schmidt decomposition of a tensor, of a state that belongs to a tensor product, Hilbert space. This is actually, if you think of this as a matrix using a basis, it's the same as what's called the singular value decomposition of that matrix. So it's a sort of somewhat deep theorem that it exists, but it's a completely well-known theorem. So it's all, and then, but then here's something that's not so well known. Which I think you could find this, can we find it in this paper that we posted on the archive recently? Something like that. So it also follows, so by Gaussian case, I mean the wave function is a Gaussian, it would be the case we're always talking about. It also follows from, I mean, it's not so well known that it follows from this, but it also follows from something that's not so well known, but should be well known. So given any two operators, any two linear operators, they don't have to be self-adjoint or Hermitian or anything, or unitary or anything like that, then, and I multiply them in either order. Of course, these operators are generally very different operators, because S, R and S don't commute, and they may not even, again, be Hermitian and whatever. But there's, they share the same spectrum, except with one caveat. So I have to say the same non-zero spectrum. One of them may have zero eigenvectors, eigenvalues that the other one doesn't, or may have more. This is including multiplicity. But if you limit yourself to the non zero ones, then if something is an eigenvalue of this, it's an eigenvalue of this, and vice versa. And if you count up the number of eigenvalues of that magnet, you know, the number of the multiplicity of that eigenvalue, you count up the number of eigenvectors with that eigenvalue, it's the same for both this and this. So that's a kind of interesting fact about linear algebra that's maybe not as widely known as it deserves to be. So any questions at this point? Yeah, I won't say in detail, but because the case we'll be studying, but what it means is that you can find variables, you can find variables which are analogs of the cube, the position variable, you know, for quantum mechanics of variables qj. And it means that psi has the form of e to the sum sort of q, say q transpose mq, something like that. So it's a with a minus sign normally, we think of m as possible. Positive. So it means that the wave function has a Gaussian form in general, a multidimensional space. And this will be the case exactly that we're in, because, which is just what we're coming to now, because as you know, for a single harmonic oscillator, simple harmonic, so the potential is like this, right? You know that the ground state looks like this, right? This is psi. It's a Gaussian. It's just sort of e to the minus x squared in some units. And this is just a single oscillator. If you have n coupled oscillators, the ground state will, as we'll see just now, will again take this form for some positive definite matrix M. So that's really what I mean by Gaussian.
And are the lesser operators attached?
In this, so there's two, right. In this, I can't tell you at this point what R and S are. Be too complicated. They're just two operators that figure in the calculation of the entropy. They're somewhat analogous Later on, we'll be talking about an operator lambda, and they're closely related to that operator lambda. We'll, in the end, we'll derive a formula where there's an operator lambda, and the entropy is given in terms of its eigenvalues by a formula that's similar to, but not the same as this formula. I mean, this is the way of saying it, in terms of eigenvalues, the trace of our log over. So that's about all I could say at this point. So the statement is that in this Gaussian case, the fact that the entanglement entropy, that the reduced entropy is the same for the one subsystem and the other, follows from this general fact. This general fact has nothing to do with Gaussian. It's just true for any two operators, let's say any two finite dimensional operators, to be, so we don't have to worry about infinite multiplicities and so on. So for any two finite dimensional operators, RS and SR share the same non-zero spectrum. If you're interested, you might like to think how you would prove this. It's a nice exercise to think about, or you might try and work it out in one or two cases. So as I stress, these are not necessarily even Hermitian operators, but nevertheless they have eigenvalues. And they, in general, just as a side, since you brought it up, I'll mention, they might not even be diagonalizable. As you probably know, not every finite dimensional operator or any finite dimensional matrix can even be diagonalized at all. But nevertheless, it still has a well-defined set of eigenvalues. It may have still some eigenvectors, and there's a well-defined multiplicity associated with that, connected to what's called the Jordan, I don't know how to pronounce it, but the Jordan normal form for the matrix. It makes little blocks, and you count the size of those blocks. So this statement actually has meaning even when R, S, and SR are not diagonalizable at all, and it still remains true. So, any other questions? Yes?
This is trivial, but I think the first part when you were saying it's a pure state if and only if, and then you mentioned the entropy, maybe you meant equals to zero?
Oh, did I not say that? Yes. Is it the first word, this word? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. If and only if this equals zero. It's pure state if and only if the entropy is zero. Okay, so let's now go to the to the actual calculation. So we'll take a bunch of coupled oscillators in the ground state, in their ground state. We can't quite do that because I'm going to need some general fact. Again, these are some facts about linear algebra. So actually, that'll be a good place, I think, to stop. We won't get beyond these general facts. So again, some of these are familiar. The first one, I think, is a little less familiar. We'll have block matrices here because the blocks will correspond to the two sets of operators, right? So I'm going to use different letters to represent the two operators. So for the full set of operators, I'll use capital Roman letters. So this is all oscillators. And to distinguish the two sets, I'll use lowercase Roman and lowercase Greek. So the ones will be like the A oscillators, and the other ones will be like the alpha operators. And say A may go from 1 to N1, and alpha may go from 1 to N2, or if you want them all to belong to the same range, you might say N1 plus 1 to N2 plus N1, okay. But anyway, there'll be two sets of you know, indices to refer to the two blocks. And let us, so now this is a matrix M, which if I use the, if I use the index notation for it, I will just write it as MAB, and then it'll consist of submatrices, which will be like MAB, Roman MA beta, and so on, M alpha beta, and so on. And I'll also, just for simplicity in stating this, I'll also assume that M is a symmetric matrix, because it will be in our application, so we'll take it to be symmetric. And now it'll have these, four blocks, which I'll label like this, A, alpha, B, beta, right? So something like MAB will be the components of this submatrix in this block and so on. MA beta will be the matrix elements of this matrix and so on. Okay. And now I'll define M with indices upstairs to be the inverse of the M with indices downstairs. So I'll define it so MAB, MBC is delta AC. That's supposed to be an uppercase C, right? Of course, I'm using this summation convention. I'm not bothering to write it. If I'm not using it, I'll let you know, or I'll try to keep straight. So this is just saying that this is M inverse. I just use the notation like we are used to in the case of the metric tensor, that the inverse matrix is given by the raised indices. However, there's another thing we can do. We can also, instead of inverting the whole matrix, we can invert the block matrix, and so we need another notation for that. So let me define with a tilde to distinguish that. I'll do it for this block, but the same formula is also meant to be used, the same notation is meant to be used for the other block. So this, when I invert only this submatrix, this is the statement that this M tilde is the inverse of the submatrix. So in order to distinguish that from the alpha beta block, you know, the Greek block of the inverse of the full matrix, I use this tilde. Okay, so is the notation clear? Now, so this is all notation, but the facts that we need are the following two things. I'll leave it as a homework, which I encourage you to do, is to check these two facts, which I'm about to write down, which relate the inverse of the whole matrix, the block of the inverse of the whole matrix, the submatrix of the whole inverse to the inverse of the submatrix. And that is MA, that's the following. Their difference, M tilde AB is equal to M A alpha, M tilde alpha beta times M beta B. That's one fact. And the other one, I don't know how to put in words what it's doing, but here's the formula for it. So this basically, I guess in words what it's doing, it's now looking at a sort of mixed product. And it, just a statement that you can write it in two different ways. See, I mean, the free indices, this B is summed over. The free indices here are A and gamma. They belong to the different types. So I could, but the in between, the thing I sum over could have been either one of them. So So if I change it from an alpha to a beta, it turns out that I get the same answer, except for a minus n. So that's the other fact that we'll need. Yeah. Oh, right, yeah, thanks. Yeah, so all notation, all variations changing Greek to Roman or raising or lowering of this definition of M are all valid. So, which is the one you asked about this? So what the notation says in that case is M tilde alpha beta M beta gamma is delta gamma alpha. Yeah, it's a bit confusing. Whereas what does this mean? So I haven't put any tilde here. So this is just the beta gamma matrix elements of the full inverse, you know. So I have MAB with a capital. This is really just MBC, let's say, which B goes to beta and C goes to gamma. And this, as I defined it, is the inverse of the, okay? Right. So there's actually, I think, four you could write down of these definitions, and they're all meant to be true. So that's one fact. I won't prove that, but it shouldn't be too hard to prove if you know, since you have the answer, you want to show that you just, what this does, for example, is it lets you express the full inverse in terms of the inverse of the subblock. And if you multiply things out, you should be able to check that you get the inverse that you're supposed to get. So one last thing, I think maybe it's a good time to, we can do this in the last 5 minutes, is keep losing the white here. This, I think, is more familiar. So this is the second very general fact that we'll be using, which is how to do Gaussian integrals. We seem to be in the unfortunate situation in physics that the only integrals we can do are Gauss, unless they're even simpler, are Gaussian integrals. Sort of all perturbation theory and quantum field theory is based on the fact that we can do Gaussian integrals. And if we could do even something slightly more complicated, you wouldn't have to write out the whole perturbation series. But we can't. So, but what we can do is Gaussian integrals. And here's the answer in general. So let's consider an n by n Gaussian integral. I mean, one for n variables. Okay, so this is a shorthand. So I really mean that A is a symmetric n by n matrix. Okay, so A is really a matrix n by n. And X is a vector, you know, an n component vector. So if I wrote it out, in indices it would look like A, B, X, A, X, B, or something. So I hope the notation is clear. And then the answer is, I'm going to put some quotes here, because I have to say what I mean by this. That's just the normalization. The important thing is this, 1/4 B, oops, yeah, B, A inverse B. So if you just read these as numbers, it's a very familiar something, result. Mathematica will tell it to you and so on. But if you, it probably won't tell you if they're matrices, but this formula still holds if A is a matrix. If I interpret, now if we're interested in the normalization, which usually we won't, need, but just to give it a definite meaning, what I mean is take the determinant of A over pi to the minus 1/2. So this you could read as sort of the determinant of A, but it's really the determinant of pi over A. So that, I mean, that's really what it is. I guess I could say it as the determinant of pi over A to the 1/2. Okay. So that's just the direct, I mean, if A has to be a symmetric matrix, in order for this integral to converge, A needs to be what's called a positive definite matrix. So all its eigenvalues need to be strictly greater than zero. And then its determinant is just, if you diagonalize it, its determinant is just the product of the eigenvalues. And this just becomes this familiar one-dimensional, just the product of one-dimensional integrals. And so that's how you can prove it. And then there's a third fact. I guess it's time to stop. So the third fact and fourth fact are also fairly familiar. So, yeah, so we'll start up next time with the calculation using, now that we have these general facts, using the coupled oscillators. I mean, working with the coupled oscillators in their ground state. So is there any questions? Okay. See you next week.